Welcome to the Ghostly Gallery Podcast, a place where we explore the world of horror in film, television, books, and popular culture. Well, greetings once again, everyone. Welcome to the show. My name is Bruce Markison, and as usual, I am joined by co-host and producer, Tracy Asteria. Hello, Tracy. How are you this week?
I'm doing great, Bruce. I am enjoying all my Cadbury Easter eggs. How's everything with you?
You know, I have to be careful with chocolate and candy. I've never actually talked about this on the air, but I was diagnosed with diabetes about 2.5 years ago. So I can't eat all the sugary stuff that I used to. Mm-hmm. And I've lost probably 25 pounds over that period of time. My wife buys me a lot of these sugar-free snacks and cookies and seems to be working pretty well. So, of course, given that it's, you know, the Easter season, I make an exception once in a while, right? Here and there. I have to pick my spots, though.
Exactly. And if you're going to have a treat, make it something that is delightful to you.
Exactly. You know, it's kind of like... Well, it's not really like, I'm going to make a crazy comparison. It's kind of like being a, you know, a vampire. You know, you have to pick your spots, you know?
Yes.
You don't want to go crazy. That's, I know, very, very strange analogy there. And one I just thought of, and maybe one of that I will regret. Actually, we're not going to be talking much about vampires this week, Tracy. Although, toward the beginning of this show, one of our earliest episodes, we did a vampire special. We interviewed an author, Michael Montgomery, who has done a book about vampires. And then we spent the rest of that episode talking about vampire themes and vampire films. This week, we're going to do something similar, but it's going to be a werewolf special. So we're going to spend our time talking about some of the best and some of our favorite werewolf-themed films that have been done over the years. And the reason I thought this would be good, it's mostly prompted by the recent news that filming has begun on a new remake of a Universal Studios classic. We have a new Wolfman that has just begun filming. This version is being directed by Lee Wannell, very talented director and writer. It's being produced by Blumhouse and Universal Studios in conjunction with each other. Wannell is the same person who directed the 2020 remake of The Invisible Man, which I love. I think is one of the best remakes of a classic horror film. And I think it's largely because of the success of that Invisible Man movie, one that starred Elizabeth Moss and Oliver Jackson Cohen. I think it's largely because that film did so well and was critically praised and deservingly so that I think this Wolfman film is getting a chance. It's being made. I think there's kind of a connection there between the two movies. And hopefully this new Wolfman, which, as I said, is being filmed as we speak, is going to be something close in quality to what we saw from the Invisible Man remake. So I wanted to get your thoughts, Tracy, when you heard about this remake for Wolfman, what are your initial reactions?
Oh my gosh, that is really hard. You know, I think it's really interesting. I'm always excited about different horror options. And, you know, Universal, they kind of made promises to their fans that they'll start bringing back, you know, reinventions of their classic horror monsters over the last couple of years. You know, they've made a couple, like you mentioned, and, you know, I've read they have lots of ideas for the future. And, you know, hopefully they'll be made. They do look exciting. I'm not 100% convinced that they should be remade, but, you know, the Universal horror movies, they're such classics, and they're classics for a reason, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, those movies from back in that time period, you know, they're phenomenal works of art. I mean, the actors, they were amazing. The scenery was beautiful. and the writing for that period of time, it's great stuff without all that modern day hoopla. You know, it just speaks to me differently. But, you know, I'm just starting to get into those classics right now, and I'm really loving them, actually. So thank you. But with the Wolfman, I'm really, really curious to see what they're going to do with it. You know, I'm curious to see how much they're going to change the original story, if they're going to rewrite it for the modern day, and are they going to go crazy with the CGI special effects? Like, I'm really curious. I'll say that much.
Well, you know, certainly you're taking a chance whenever you're going to remake great movies, even if they're from, you know, 80, 90 years ago. Mm-hmm. We've seen some of these have been disasters. You know, I don't really have anything against Tom Cruise as an actor, but his film, The Mummy, a remake, was really pretty awful and very disappointing. There was also a film done, I don't know if you can call it a remake. It was kind of a different angle to the Dracula story that was done. And again, that was from Universal. And it was okay, but it wasn't great. And then you have something like Invisible Man, which I thought was outstanding. I thought the movie with Moss and Jackson Cohen was actually better than the original. And the original is considered an absolute classic. So you're taking a chance. It's hard. It's hard to match the impact of the original. You know, you want to take something from the original story, but you also want to take it into some different directions. You don't want to just remake scene for scene, shot for shot. There's really an art to doing a remake. And sometimes we've seen Universal hit, and other times we've seen them miss. So we'll have to wait and see exactly which category this is going to fall into. Now, it's interesting, Tracy, that at one point, the rumor was that Ryan Gosling, who's certainly an A-list actor, was going to play the title character in this new Wolfman. But now he's not going to do that. He's still involved as one of the film's producers, but he's not going to be acting in the film. So the title role is now going to be handled by a lesser-known actor named Christopher Abbott. Now, he's not at the same level of fame as Ryan Gosling, but I did see him in the first season of The Sinner, the series with Bill Pullman, and I thought Christopher Abbott was really good in that role. And I think he has maybe the look of the Wolfman, Larry Talbot. He has kind of a, I don't know, kind of a somber-looking face. I think this actually might be a good fit, even though he doesn't have as much brand name value as Ryan Gosling. I also love the fact that another key cast member is Julia Garner, who was so good as the colorful and very foul-mouthed Ruth Langmore on the series Ozark. She is going to play a young mother in Wolfman. Her family is attacked by a werewolf, or I guess she is attacked by a werewolf, and then she has to protect her family in the aftermath of that. So some promising actors are in this. They've recently added a guy named Sam Yeager, an actor from The Handmaid's Tale. He's also going to be part of the cast. So I know the cast can't tell you everything, but I think that's at least a good sign right there.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm not overly familiar with those cast members, but, you know, I think they'll do really good. I mean, if Ryan Gosling is going to be involved too, and, you know, it's a combination with, you know, Universal, I really think it could work. You know, I just can't wait to see what they actually bring to the table.
Did you watch Ozark by chance?
I have not.
Well, it's not a horror series. It's a series about a guy and his family who are put kind of in a dangerous financial situation. They're threatened by cartel members from south of the border, and they basically have to uproot their family to the Ozarks and launder money for this cartel. And they end up meeting the character of Ruth Langmore, the character who is played by Julia Garner. And I think she's actually the best character. You know, she swears at every turn, almost to the point of being comical. but she's also a pretty likable character as well, and one that I think a lot of people had sympathy for. She's a really good actress, and I think she'll probably do a good job in this. So I think that's a good sign. Filming, by the way, has just begun this month, March of 2024. It's underway in New Zealand. Now, they're saying that this new Wolfman is tentatively scheduled for release in late October of this year. That sounds a bit ambitious to me, but maybe they'll deliver just before Halloween. Maybe they'll, for once, be on schedule with one of these horror films. We've seen that's not always been the case in the past, but something to look forward to. Wolfman, tentatively scheduled October of 2024.
Oh, no, Bruce, I have to disappoint you. Not that long ago, just a couple of hours ago, I read an article online about this movie, and they have changed the date as of March 29th. So just a couple of days ago, they said it will hit theaters on January the 17th of 2025. So they've already pushed that back.
So much for my optimism. Yeah.
So,
well, you know, that does sound more realistic.
It does. I think it hopefully gives them more time to kind of polish things off and really, you know, start with some of their advertising and get the audience really geared up to go see that. Is this going to be something that you're going to go to the theater to see when it's released?
I think I'd like to. You know, there's a couple of new horror films that are out now that I'm really tempted to go to the theater. And, you know, shame on me. I have not been back to the theater since the pandemic started in 2020. And I've been a few times that I've been tempted, and then I've ended up streaming movies that I could have gone, you know, and seen in person. I'm hoping between now and then that I'll have already been back to the theater. The new movie with Sydney Sweeney about the nun, that looks interesting. Mm-hmm. And there's also the one that's set in the 1970s about the talk show host and the devil. The actor from The Last Voyage of the Demeter is in that, David Dalmatian. I hopefully not butchered his name too much. So that's another interesting film. So I'm hoping to get out to the theater to see at least one of these. Wolfman, January 17th, 2025. Only thing that's weird about that, January is where they often release films that they don't think are very good. And this one, they don't even know yet because it's being filmed right now. So maybe they don't want to wait all the way until Halloween of 2025. And maybe when they figured, well, we can't make Halloween 2024, so maybe this is the compromise. But we'll look forward to it, January 2025, the new edition of Wolfman. So, Tracy, we wanted to talk about some of our favorite werewolf movies of all time. I had a list of three, and you're going to offer some comments on these as well. And then you had another film that you wanted to talk about. And then a bit later on, we're going to talk about an interesting werewolf movie that's not as well known as some of these other movies we're going to discuss. And it's a movie that celebrates its 50th anniversary. It came out in April of 1974, 50 years ago. And we'll tell you the name of that movie in a few minutes, a little bit later on in the show. I'm going to give you my three favorite werewolf movies of all time, and I want to get your thoughts on each one. So at number three on my list is a movie from 1985. It's called Silver Bullet. Believe it or not, only 5 years ago, I'd never actually seen this adaptation of the Stephen King story Cycle of the Werewolf. I'd heard of it. I hadn't seen it for whatever reason. And then a couple of years ago, I did watch it, loved it. It's really grown on me quickly. There are some problems with it. The werewolf costuming is not ideally that great, certainly not as good as some of the other films we'll be discussing, but it has likable and heroic characters. It's a creative story, and I think it's a film that has a lot of heart, if that's possible for a horror movie. So as I said, it is based on a short story by Stephen King. Silver Bullet is set in the mythical and mostly peaceful town of Tarker's Falls, where a series of murders have begun to take place, interrupting, you know, the generally quiet nature of this town. Most of the residents believe there is a serial killer to blame here. But a young boy in a wheelchair named Marty Koslaw believes there is a werewolf clawing its way through the town. And this character of Marty Koslaw, young boy, is played by a very young Corey Haim. He's really good in it. A couple of notes of interest about Silver Bullet. When the film came out in the mid-80s, it didn't receive that much attention at the time. Certainly paled in comparison to another Corey Haim film of that era, The Lost Boys, which was a huge hit and also a critical success. But Silver Bullet still made a small profit for the studio. And really, in the years since its release, it has become a cult classic, often cited as one of the better werewolf films ever made. And certainly I agree with that, putting it at number 3 on my list. Gary Busey plays Uncle Red, who is essentially taking care of the Corey Haim character and his sister. Now, this is Gary Busey in one of his younger roles before he had a lot of the physical and medical problems that have plagued him in later years. He's really good. He ad-libs a lot of his lines. He's very likable. He's, you know, someone who gives encouragement to Marty, who's in a wheelchair. It's really a positive, upbeat role. Now, he did ad-lib, he did improvise a lot of his lines, and apparently the director, Daniel Attias, went along with that and basically kept his improvisation in the final cut of the movie. I guess he got approval from Stephen King on that because Busey had some lines that were not from the book itself, but King approved, thought it was okay, and it worked out. Also interesting, Busey, who is still pretty young at this point, did all of his own stunts during the making of the film. Now, the biggest problem with the movie, maybe really the only big weakness, is the werewolf costume itself. And that's drawn some criticism, lacking in realism. It was actually kind of constructed on the fly during the filming process. So they may not have had the full time to really put the effort into making this, you know, look realistic and believable. Also, they had a werewolf head that needed to be operated mechanically by a group of 6 different people, and they were located like at least 30 feet away. So that sounds real complicated, but all things considered, you know, I don't think the costuming is bad. It's maybe mediocre. And it's maybe a small criticism, but I don't think it detracts from what is otherwise a good film. Other than this werewolf effect, the film is very entertaining. It's well-paced. As I said, it's got many likable characters played by Haim, Busey, and Megan Follows. She plays Haim's older sister, and the story is actually told from her perspective. And there's also a great performance by another character actor, Everett McGill. He's not so likable. He's kind of in one of his typical villain roles, and he's always really good in that. So he gives a little counterbalance to the goodness of the other people. But I really like this one. It's become one of my favorites very quickly. Silver Bullet, 3.5 stars. Your thoughts, Tracy?
Oh, wow. 3.5 stars. Oh, that's amazing. I haven't really watched this movie before in its entirety. I've only ever seen bits and pieces of it, and I don't remember a whole lot of the movie, which is really terrible on my part because, you know, as a kid, I loved Corey Haim. I'm a kid from the 80s, so he was a big icon. And, you know, Stephen King loved his books. So I'm not really sure why I haven't gotten around to see the movie, but if you rate it 3.5 stars, that's on my list for next weekend. Absolutely.
You know, I think Corey Haim is really good here. It was one of his early movies. It's one of those movies where he's not in it with Corey Feldman. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he you see the talent that he had. And it's just sad that we lost him at such a young age because, you know, I think there was the potential for him to have been, you know, a really considerable actor with a significant career that went beyond just, you know, a few movies early on. But you see the talent, you see the charisma that he had. And I think he's actually better in this than he is in The Lost Boys, where he has to share a lot of time with his brother and with the other two kids who are, you know, part of the local vampire busting group. In some ways, this is maybe more of a serious role for him. He is playing a young boy in a wheelchair. And the relationship between him and Gary Busey is really quite compelling. You feel good for both of these guys. So I think it shows the talent that Corey Haim had. And it's just a shame that, you know, we lost him so young.
Exactly.
So that's number three on the list. Yeah, go ahead. You want to say something?
Yeah, I was curious. Because this movie is from the 80s, like, what would your thoughts be if they kind of reinvented this particular film and brought this back, you know, with a bit of a bigger budget and more modern day special effects, especially, you know, pertaining to the werewolf? Like, do you think that would go over well? Or do you think that would just be crossing that line of don't remake that movie?
I think actually it would be a good idea. You know, assuming you have a bigger budget, mm-hmm. and with costuming effects being more sophisticated today, you could create a much better and more believable werewolf. You'd also need a good child actor. And child acting today, I think, is so much more advanced than it's ever been. Now, Haim was really good in this 1985 movie, but there's a lot of child actors who you see them on screen, and it feels like they've been acting for 15 years, even though they're only 10. So I think they could easily find somebody to play that role. I don't know who would handle the Gary Busey role. To me, the biggest concern is that, all right, even if you have a bigger budget, you have a better werewolf, I would hope a remake isn't so slick that it loses some of the grit and the heart that this movie has. Right. That would be my one concern. But I think potentially, yeah, I think this could be a good one.
Awesome. Oh, that's good to know. I'm a big fan of Gary Busey too. And, you know, I really have to see this movie because I would love to see him in that kind of a role, just to see how he portrays it. So,
yeah. People forget how good an actor he was during the 1980s, especially, you know, before he had an accident, he had all these health problems. They've affected his speaking ability. Mm-hmm. But Gary Busey in his prime was a major talent. I mean, he was in the first Lethal Weapon movie. He plays this really dastardly villain that goes up against Mel Gibson and Danny Glover. You know, he could do comedy. He could do dramatic roles. He could play the everyman. He could be good guys, bad guys. 1980s, Gary Busey, you know, put together quite a library of good films and good roles. And maybe, I know it's a long time ago, but people maybe have forgotten about the kind of talent that he had. He also, by the way, has a son who I think is pretty good too, Jake Busey, who has been doing a lot of stuff. And I had a chance to see Jake speak at the convention we used to have in upstate New York called Scaricon. It took place at the casino in Verona, New York, not far from where I live. And he was great to hear him talk. He was very honest. He was talking about one of the films that he was in, which had a couple of A-list actors. And I'm not going to say who they are. I'm going to spare them. But he basically came out and said these two guys were absolute prima donnas. And it was a good movie. And you know, it didn't affect the quality of the film. But I got the sense that he didn't have a lot of patience for their prima donna act. And he really seems like the opposite of that. He seems like a down-to-earth guy and a guy that is willing to, you know, take on just about any role. I think Jake is really good. maybe not quite at the level of his father yet, but still young, still got hopefully a long way to go. So that's our first movie from the werewolf genre. Next up, number two on my list, is really a terrific movie. It's a modern day classic from 1981, An American Werewolf in London. So this came out of the year 1981, where there were three excellent werewolf movies. It's been called the Year of the Werewolf. One of the movies was Wolfen, excellent. A second was The Howling. That's another favorite of mine. But my choice for number two on my list of werewolf favorites is An American Werewolf in London. It's not only an entertaining film, but a groundbreaking film also. It stars two likable actors, David Naughton and a young Griffin Dunne, who has really gone on to do a lot more as a director than as an actor. But at this time, he was a young actor. So they play two American backpackers. I don't think they ever specify that they're in college, but I get the sense they're college students. They're on a break, and they're backpacking through the English moors. Their characters are friendly, but also a bit goofy, and that fits in because the film has a lot of comic tendencies. Then the film turns rather serious after they've annoyed some hard-edged local characters at a remote pub called the Slaughtered Lamb. I believe that was the name. They then make a hasty exit because they've kind of offended these people. And they figure, let's get out of here before we put our feet in our mouth a little bit more. So they walk out of the pub. They're warned, stick to the roads, do not walk on the moors. This is in Northern England. And of course, they lose track of where they are. All of a sudden, they find they're not on the road anymore. They're in the moors. And that's when they are attacked by a creature, which turns out to be a werewolf. Dunn's character, named Jack Goodman, is killed, while Naughton's character, named David Kessler, survives. But even though he survives, he basically loses consciousness for 3 weeks. He ends up waking up in a hospital and kind of enters his own nightmare world, which is really what most of the movie is about. So this one is directed by John Landis. It's very good across the board, from the story to the acting to the absolutely sensational special effects that came from Rick Baker. In fact, they won an Academy Award in 1981. The on-air transformation of man to wolf, which was coordinated by Baker, is probably the best of its kind that's ever been filmed in a horror movie. I mean, it's just incredible. You watch this movie, it's 1981, you think it's a film from 2021. It's just so ahead of its time. It's really, really good. The film also has a very good soundtrack, kind of a modern day soundtrack for that period of time, you know, late 70s, early 80s. There is real chemistry between Naughton and Jenny Agutter, who plays the nurse charged with bringing him back to good health. They fall in love. It's very believable. Naughton, who's a very nice guy in person, I've met him as well at Scarecon, and he succeeds in making his character both very likable but also very sad as he has to deal with the reality of the aftermath of the attack. Not only has he lost his friend, but it turns out he's not completely unscathed from the attack either. And for those who haven't seen the film, I don't want to give away any more. And then you talk about the werewolf depictions. They're really good. Even after the transformations, which are fantastic, are done, you see the werewolves making their way around. They're realistic. They're frightening. All top-notch. This is a movie that has really a little bit of everything. A nice blend of horror and comedy. Sometimes hard to get a balance between the two, but this one does. Has sympathetic characters, has a love affair, and as I said, the most remarkable on-screen transformation of man to werewolf that probably anybody has ever seen. It's now more than 40 years later, but the film about lycanthropy holds up. It's really a modern-day classic. 4 stars for An American Werewolf in London. Any thoughts on it, Tracy?
Oh, my goodness, Bruce. You know, this film right here is the very first horror film that I ever watched. So I was just a kid when I saw it, and I remember watching it. You know, I believe my parents rented it on VHS, and it scared me to death. I was pretty much scarred for a very, very long time after seeing that movie. The first couple of weeks after watching it, I was literally paranoid I was going to turn into a werewolf. Like, I kept looking at my hands and watching my feet. I mean, I was like maybe 8, maybe 10 years old. And, you know, my bedroom was in the basement. So I was down there by myself and I was so scared.
Why were you living in the basement?
My dad built me my own room in the basement so I wouldn't have to share a room with my siblings. So I was like, you know, down there all to myself, but it was pretty darn scary because I watched that movie and then I was sent right to bed and I was like, jeez. Yeah.
Now I have to ask you, the basement, did it have windows?
It did.
Okay, so you could see the full moon. It could have an impact on you. That's what you were worried about, right?
That's right. The light shining through the basement windows, right?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. It was a surreal experience, you know, and I know it sounds absolutely ridiculous, but as a kid, man, that movie stuck with me for years and years and years. And I just watched it again for the first time since then, just a couple of years ago. And, you know, it really brought back some of those fears again. And again, it's just kind of ridiculous that it makes me feel that way. But that's how much of an impression that movie left on me. It was great.
What scene were you most scared by? Was it the early scene in the moors? Was it the transformation?
It was the transformation. Yeah. That is what really got me. Like, everything was eerie and kind of scary anyway, but that transformation, I think, is what really pushed me over the edge. You know, like you said, it was groundbreaking, and the visual effects during, you know, the werewolf transformation was phenomenal. I've never seen anything like that before, right? And, you know, I read that Michael Jackson was a huge fan of this movie, and that's what inspired his music video Thriller. And, you know, because of his love for John Landis's work, he actually had him bring that video to life. So, you know, it was just an epic piece of movie history and music history too, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, it just, the lasting impression, it started my journey onto horror. So, you know what? Just for those reasons right there, it earns 4 stars from me too.
Yeah. Tracy, when you first watched it, you talk about how frightened you were. Did you get through it right off the bat? Or did it take a second time to go back and finish it off?
No, I sat there and I think, you know, my knuckles were white, my fists were clenched, and I just sat there, you know, very quietly watching that entire movie and then got sent right down to bed. And, you know, I never looked back. I did not watch that movie again, you know, didn't even cross my mind to watch it just because it affected me. I was so scared, but, you know, it's not really as scary as it was back then. But still, kind of gives me the, you know, scaries once in a while. When did you see that? When was the first time you saw that movie, Bruce?
Believe it or not, I actually saw it in the theater.
Oh, I know.
I'm guessing it was in New York City. I lived in Westchester County, suburbs of New York City. And I have vague memories. It was downtown Manhattan at kind of a dark theater. So I did see it at first on the big screen. Mm. And then I've seen it, you know, several times since then. I just rewatched part of it the other night. Certainly seeing it on the big screen, that transformation is even more powerful. But even on a smaller TV, it's still wonderful. What Baker did there is just incredible. 1981, we're talking, what, 43 years ago. I don't know that we've seen a werewolf transformation as good, or certainly not any better. I haven't seen it. Maybe I've missed something, but I still think that's the standard bearer. And in an industry like film and Hollywood, where things, filmmaking techniques are constantly improving and advancing, that says a lot that something like that from almost 45 years ago still holds up as the top of the game.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know what? Like, that's one movie that they just need to kind of leave alone. Don't touch that one, right?
Yeah.
I don't think they can improve it.
Yeah. I think that's one that there's no need to try to remake it. It's just so good as it is. Mm-hmm. Also, I want to mention David Naughton is really a terrific guy. I interviewed him on a panel at Scaricon a few years back, and he was great. He had tremendous memory of working with Jenny Agutter and Griffin Dunn, and tremendous recall. He was very nice. He actually complimented me after the interview, and I was kind of hoping we would stay in touch. That really hasn't happened. I'm hoping at some point we can get him on the show. I know that he's done a lot of podcasts, and I think right now he's a little bit worn out from that, but I'm hoping at some point in the future we can talk to him, because he's such a nice guy and has really interesting thoughts. He's a thoughtful guy, and I think he has something to offer. He's in some other horror as well. He was in John Carpenter's Body Bags in the 1990s, and he's done a few other films, but certainly An American Werewolf in London is the peak of his game, no question.
Oh, wow. Oh, that would have been an amazing conversation. I can't even imagine.
We'll keep trying on that one. In the meantime, though, we move to our number one, or at least my number one film, and it is the film that came out in 1941, a black and white movie that presents the tragic story of Lawrence Talbot, son of an English nobleman. Talbot returns to his native land only to be bitten by a werewolf, and that leads to an unwanted transformation on nights when a full moon appears. And I am talking about the 1941 Universal Studios classic, The Wolfman. Here are a few things about the film that are particularly interesting. Number one, The Wolfman was not based on a book at all. Whereas, you know, Dracula was certainly influenced by Bram Stoker, and Frankenstein, even though it's very different from Mary Shelley's book, there are still some connections there. There was no Wolfman book that influenced this. This was something that really came out of Hollywood whole cloth. And it's a movie that's responsible for much of the werewolf lore that has been passed down over the years. For example, the movie came up with this concept that a werewolf bite will transform a person into a wolfman. Also, it came up with the idea that there's a need for a silver bullet in order to kill a werewolf, and that comes from this film, too. Lon Chaney Jr., one of my favorites, is exceptional as the title character. At the time, there were a lot of people who wondered about his casting. People thought he's a limited actor. He doesn't have a lot of range. He's not that great. A lot of that turned out to just be nonsense. He's exceptional in the role. He's so good, he would play the Wolfman over the course of four additional movies, so five in total. And he's really outstanding in all of them. I mean, there's nobody that could play this role better than Lon Chaney. And that's why Universal never had anybody else play this role. As an added bonus, the movie has Bela Lugosi. He plays not a vampire, but a gypsy slash werewolf. He'd badly wanted to play the lead, but he was actually turned down. It's about 10 years after Dracula came out. He'd fallen into some disfavor with Universal. They were only giving him bit roles and supporting cast roles. So he settles for a much smaller role as the character, the gypsy, who does have this werewolf identity that he's hiding. And appropriately enough, he's given the name of Bela, or Bela, as we should properly say. So he's not in the movie a lot, but he's an integral part of what happens early on. So it's kind of cool that you have Chaney and Lugosi there together for a short time. Chaney, by the way, was very much disliked by his co-star, Evelyn Ankers. He apparently didn't treat her very well. He called her Shankers on set, kind of an insult. and repeatedly played practical jokes on her. She did not like that at all. Despite the tension that existed in real life between Anchors and Chaney, the two really display legitimate on-screen chemistry throughout the film, the potential love interest, but of course it's all interfered with by the fact that he does become a werewolf during nights when there is a full moon. Wolfman is not only my favorite werewolf-themed film of all time, it's one of my favorite films, period, in horror. I absolutely love it. It has interesting characters. It moves quickly. Gives us a classic presentation of a monster who cannot control the changes that turn him into a violent and murderous beast. You really feel sympathy, really sadness for Chaney. He obviously doesn't want this fate. He doesn't know what he's doing when he becomes a werewolf. A lot of times he doesn't have memory of what has occurred. And then he hears that somebody's been killed and he kind of figures out, I must have been the one that did it. But there's nothing he can do to avoid it or control it. And that does make him a sad character as well as being a villainous one. So the Universal classic, for me, remains supreme here, thanks mostly to this great performance from Lon Chaney Jr. Very good special effects for the time. The werewolf transformation that we see, it's not at the level of what Rick Baker would do many years later, but for that period of time, it was outstanding and still holds up pretty well. There's also all this creative werewolf lore that was introduced. I think that's fascinating. And one of the things that comes out of it, this belief that werewolves only turn during a full moon. So we have all of that in The Wolfman. Terrific film, 4 stars for this classic from 1941. Tracy, your thoughts on The Wolfman?
Oh, wow. Well, first of all, I was not aware that this movie created the werewolf lore. I had no idea. So I think, you know, that's just another epic tip of the hat to the writers and the actors and the entire film crew.
Correction. I don't want to say that it created all of it, because there were some other films before. Werewolf of London came out several years before. But this is the one I think that's most lasting in terms of what you would see in later werewolf
movies. Right. Oh, my gosh. I thought it was excellent. You know, I really thought that Lon Chaney Jr., he was fantastic in the role. He was well suited, you know, to really bring that character to life. You know, I know you mentioned that Bela Lugosi really wanted that role, but I can never think of him in the role of the Wolfman. I just don't think it would have worked. But I just think he did great. And the one fact that I found interesting is I did a little bit of research into Lon Chaney and Evelyn Anchors. Is it Anchors? Anchors?
Anchors, I believe.
Anchors. And I was not aware that the two didn't get along, because you would never be able to tell with all of the performances that they had together. They looked like they were a wonderful couple in whatever they played. But one thing I found really quite interesting is she actually was married to the actor Richard Denning. I didn't know that. And Richard Denning is one of my favorite old-time radio actors, voice actors. So I thought that was phenomenal.
Just is he the one in Creature from the Black Lagoon?
It is. Yeah, that's okay. Him too. Yeah.
I did not know they were married. Wow.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. And they have a daughter, Diana Denning. And I believe she might have got into acting as well. But yeah, I really enjoyed this movie, Bruce. It's the ultimate total classic. And, you know, I'd have to agree with you. That's 4 stars. And I honestly didn't realize it came out in 1941. So, wow, that's an old movie, but it's a goodie. I'll tell you that.
Yeah. And, you know, the fact that it came out 10 years after Dracula, which was very primitive, in it had almost no special effects, very little music. It has kind of some dead spots in the movie. It's not a smooth film. It was one of the early movies made of the sound era, Mm-hmm. And you could tell they were still feeling their way. Well, 10 years later, the Wolfman is so much better in terms of special effects, the music, just the way the film moves from one scene to another. It's much smoother production. So you can see the improvement they were making in just a decade. It's certainly the case there. So we both love The Wolfman, both give it 4 stars. Now, you have a movie you'd like to talk about, much more recent. It's from 2021. Tell us about it.
Yeah. So I kind of wanted to go for something a little bit out of the ordinary when it came to werewolf movies. And I found one that didn't disappoint, which, you know, given the fact that it's a modern day movie, you know, you just never know with those kind of movies. So I watched it. It's a 2021 gothic horror release. It's called The Cursed. And this movie was written and directed by Sean Ellis. This movie was originally called 8 for Silver, and it wasn't released in the United States until February of 2022. So the film stars Boyd Holbrook. And for those of you that don't know, he played in Indiana Jones and the Dial of the Destiny. He also played in the TV series The Sandman, as well as multiple other projects. Another star is Kelly Riley. She played in the TV series Yellowstone and the movie A Haunting in Venice and multiple other titles. And the other main actor is Alistair Petrie, and I'm pretty sure I said that right. He's known for his role in Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. So he played the role of General Draven. And he also played the chief inspector in the movie Victor Frankenstein. And he has tons of other roles. And he's also a director, too, if I understand that correctly. And some of the supporting cast members, you know, newcomers. So Mac McIntosh and Amelia Crouch. So this movie, it's set in the 19th century. But it initially opens up on the battlefield in France in 1917. So I honestly thought I put the wrong movie on by mistake because it was just such a weird way to start the movie. I wasn't expecting it. But I'll just kind of like leave it at that because it's kind of a spoiler alert because those initial moments of the film will tie directly into the ending to kind of give you that, oh, wow, your aha moment, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, it was an interesting way to start the film. So kind of getting back to the movie, it focuses on the Laurent family. They appear to be a well-off and family. They live in a really big home with servants. The father, Seamus, is played by Alistair Petrie. You know, he's kind of the ruler of the village. So he and his group of associates decide to take matters into their own hands and make a claim to land that they believe belonged to the village. But this land in question is actually home to a group of Romanian tribespeople. So, you know, Seamus and associates ride down to the tribespeople, and in the most horrific and graphic scene, they burn the houses down, you know, their tents, they kill the people, and the men take it upon themselves to teach the gypsies a lesson. They take one of the men and gruesomely cut his hands and his feet off, and they raise him up on a platform, kind of like a scarecrow for everybody to see. And the man's wife is there to witness this atrocity, and she herself was buried alive. And that's just, you know, within the first 20 minutes of this movie. Like, that's kind of a lot to take in.
Yeah.
The focus is on a set of silver teeth. So they're monstrous, kind of like wolf-like fangs that kind of resemble dentures, I guess, if you like. This box with the silver teeth are buried into the ground. And from that moment on, the curse has been issued to Seamus and his family and the entire village. So the children start dreaming of the scarecrow and then the wolf-like teeth. They are all experiencing the same kind of nightmares. And eventually the children make their way down to where this scarecrow really is. The one boy digs up this mysterious box with the silver teeth. The boy puts these teeth in his mouth and something kind of takes over him. And he turns around and he bites the neck of Seamus's son, Edward. And the boy has no memory of doing that. But Edward survives the bite. He's really sick and he's brought back home to heal. But eventually he escapes into the woods, never to be seen again. After, you know, the search, you know, the town searched for him. They couldn't find him. Animal attacks start happening. People are bitten. Some survive, but some are sick. Others are actually killed. And then this is when John McBride enters, who's played by Boyd Holbrook. He's a pathologist with a dark history. His own family had been killed by wolf-like creatures. And he's made it his mission in life to hunt these creatures down and kill them. Now, I don't want to give the whole story away because it's really worth the time. It's actually, the time is 1 hour and 50 minutes to watch this film. So it's kind of long. But, you know, Bruce, the story touches on the original Wolfman movie, the lore. So you have the curse of the gypsies. Silver can kill these creatures. If someone is bitten by the werewolf, they'll turn into this creature. Now, the creature werewolf, it's not what you expect a typical werewolf to look like. It's not like this hairy beast, but it resembles more of what I would call a demon werewolf creature. It's gruesome and it's vicious. You don't see it a lot, but when you do, it's like it takes your breath away. It's like, holy cow, what is that?
Yeah.
It's the atmosphere is really dark, both physically, you know, and leaves the viewer emotionally drained. Like it's a roller coaster ride. You know, it takes that werewolf story to an incredible level that you don't expect. You know, bits and pieces can be slow, but it's one of those films I need to watch again to make sure I didn't miss anything, just to get that full experience, right? Man, there's so much to this movie, and I highly recommend it. It's a great story. The effects were really great. And, you know, the ending, it's a twist of an ending, but you won't see that coming. You know, it's got everything you could ever ask for. It's got mythology, supernatural, history, and just such a unique take on the story. I give this 4 stars. And, you know, it only made $4.6 million at the box office during its release. But I think it's one of those movies that might not be as well known as some of the others. Right. But, you know, definitely worth it. Definitely.
Sounds interesting. I want to see it.
Definitely need to.
Yeah. Let me see if I have this right. So whoever takes these silver teeth and puts them in their mouth, they become a werewolf?
So that's how it started. Yeah. And you only see the teeth like once or twice in this movie. And it started by kind of like, I want to say like the village bully kid puts these teeth in his mouth and bites the son of Seamus. And then Seamus's child, Edward, he goes home and he basically transforms into a beast, a werewolf. And then he starts killing other members of the village. But you only see the teeth a couple of times. And the pathologist, the wolf hunter, he actually makes those teeth and turns them into silver bullets. And you'll see at the very beginning of the movie, one of those silver bullets on the battlefield. I will say no more.
Okay. Well, it sounds really good. And again, it's the cursed from 2021. You give it 4 stars.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Excellent. So those are a few of the films that we picked out. There are a lot of other good werewolf movies to consider. They include Werewolf of London, which was one of the earliest, if not the earliest, full-length feature films about werewolves. You had Hammer Films' Curse of the Werewolf in the early 1960s. We talked earlier about Wolfen and The Howling from 1981. There's also Ginger Snaps. There were a couple of those movies. The first one is exceptional. I mean, I easily could put that one in the top five or six. I only did my top three, but Ginger Snaps, we probably should talk about on a future show. Right. We also haven't mentioned that there was a 2010 remake of The Wolfman with Benicio del Toro, which I think is quite good. He's in it. Anthony Hopkins is in it. It takes the original Wolfman story. It's set in the same time period, but then goes off into some very different directions. I thought that was a good movie. It didn't get a lot of publicity, but that was a decent remake. There's also Dog Soldiers, which is a film that combines werewolves with the military. There's a group on a military operation that's supposed to be routine. It goes very, very wrong as they encounter werewolf creatures. That's a film that a lot of people really like. And then another recent film is called Late Phases, which I saw just last year. Again, not that well known, but quite a good movie. These are all legitimately good movies. We only picked four. We could not pick all of those to discuss. But if we do another werewolf special, we'll have to delve into some of those. So, Tracy, during the final segment of this show, I'd like to talk about another movie from this genre. It's a film that debuted 50 years ago, April of 1974. It's a film that's not nearly as well known as some of the movies that we've been talking about, certainly not as well known as American Werewolf in London or The Wolfman or The Howling, but it's one that I think is worth talking about. And it's called The Beast Must Die. It was produced by Amicus, which made some really nice horror films, especially anthology films in the 1960s and 70s. This one's not an anthology. It's one continuous story. It was made on a really low budget by Amicus. They usually spent money on their anthologies, but they didn't spend a lot of money here. But it's still a creative film starring a very underrated actor named Calvin Lockhart. He plays Tom Newcliffe, a wealthy big game hunter, who has invited five associates to his country mansion somewhere in England. He suspects that one of the five is actually a monstrous werewolf. And it's basically a mystery. He spends this entire weekend at his country estate trying to determine which of these people, all of whom have some questionable backgrounds, he wants to figure out which one is actually the werewolf, and he wants to destroy it. I really love Lockhart in this movie. He has a strong physical presence, an elaborate selection of clothing. On the opening scene, he wears knee-length boots as he's being chased around by soldiers that he's paid. He's trying to test out his security system because he wants the security system working 100% right to help him capture the werewolf. And he doesn't want the werewolf to gain access to his actual house. So he goes through this whole thing where these fake soldiers are pursuing him, pretending to capture him, pretending to shoot him. And he's basically trying to find out if there are any flaws in the security system. And he has a guy that he's paid to run all the computers and the cameras and the microphones. And he wants to make sure that the thing is foolproof. And as it turns out, it's actually not. One of the really interesting things about Lockhart, he has a very unusual manner of speaking throughout the film. His cadence is kind of offbeat. It's kind of a clipped way of speaking. It's an accent I can't really identify. It's not a British accent. It's not really an American accent. I don't know, maybe it's the mid-Atlantic accent that some people in Hollywood used to have. It's very unusual, very distinctive, but it works. You get the sense this guy is eccentric, but at the same time, he is brilliant. We should mention that he was a black actor, and along with Dwayne Jones and William Marshall, Dwayne Jones starred in Night of the Living Dead, William Marshall starred in the Blackula movies. So along with those two men, Lockhart is one of the first black actors to play a lead role in a horror film, and he's excellent. Every time he is in a scene, and he's in most of the scenes, he really commands your attention. And that's saying a lot, because the number two billed actor is the great Peter Cushing. So Lockhart is the star. Cushing is really second on the list. And he does a really good job, too. He plays an expert on werewolves who studies the whole idea of lycanthropy from a scientific standpoint. Then there's another accomplished actor named Charles Gray, who plays a disgraced politician. He was a guy that starred in an earlier Hammer film, The Devil Rides Out, about witchcraft and satanic cults. It's the one with Christopher Lee. Gray plays the villain in that movie. Here he's more of an innocent character than anything else, but he's very good. One of the other interesting things about this movie, it utilizes a 30-second werewolf break near the conclusion, where viewers are asked to guess the identity of the monster, the werewolf. It's kind of reminiscent of what director William Castle did in earlier years when he gave us films like House on Haunted Hill and Mr. Sardonicus. He would have some kind of a gimmick that would get the crowd, the audience involved, and they would usually take some sort of a break during the movie, and then they would have the big reveal toward the end. And that's kind of what they did in this movie, too. This was not the director's idea. Paul Annett was his name. He didn't like it, but the producers wanted it. And even though it's a bit hokey, it actually, it works. It creates some suspense. It presents all the possible werewolf candidates, and it gives you one final chance to think, okay, who really is the werewolf? One scene in particular that I really like, it's toward the beginning of the film. It's the first night when they're at Tom Newcliffe's estate, and they're being served dinner. And while they're being served dinner, Peter Cushing is going on about the science of werewolves and how they've originated, what their strengths and weaknesses are. He gets very graphic. He talks about this in gory detail, all while raw steak is being served to each of the guests. And a couple of them become almost violently ill. They just can't take hearing about this while raw bloody steak is being put on the plate in front of them. So it's a really effective scene. It has some comic elements as well, but it all works. The only part of the film that doesn't work, there's a lack of an actual werewolf that can be seen on camera. Amicus did not provide a lot of money to director Paul Annett, so he had to use a large wolf-like dog to play the part of the werewolf in several scenes. So it's a dog running around. I don't even know what kind of dog it is. Pretty big dog, pretty ferocious. Mm-hmm. Clearly not a werewolf. So this is a setback. That was the one problem. With a little more money, with better effects, with a real werewolf costume, The Beast Must Die could have been a classic from the 1970s. It's really a film crying out for a current day remake where more money and better special effects could make it a very formidable film. Even without much money, even without a real werewolf, it's still pretty good. It's entertaining. It's worthwhile. It's set up as a mystery. It has compelling characters like Tom Newcliffe, like the scientist played by Peter Cushing. The acting is really good. It keeps you guessing. I mean, the first time I saw the movie, I had no idea who the werewolf was. And then the second time, I think I forgot who the werewolf was, and I was looking for clues, and I couldn't remember, and I couldn't figure it out the second time either. So they really do keep you guessing. It's a lot of fun. Lockhart himself is worth it. I mean, just to see the way that he moves and talks, they think he's a little bit crazy, but you get the sense that, yeah, he's actually a lot smarter than them. He knows there's a werewolf there, even as crazy as that might sound. So Lockhart himself, who sadly passed away in 2007 and really didn't get the roles that he should have gotten, perhaps because of the racism of the day, but he's excellent in the movie. He really carries it along with Cushing. It's not a classic. It's not what I would call a great film, not a 4-star film, but I'll go with 3 stars. 3 stars for The Beast Must Die. Now, I know you've had a chance to watch it, Tracy. What'd you think of it?
I have. I actually watched this last night. It was interesting. I'll say I didn't know really anything about this film. I just popped it on and, you know, that first scene that you started talking about with him running around in the woods, I was like, what the heck is going on here? what is this? And, but, you know, once that story got started, you know, it was pretty good. You know, the initials 1970s music kind of gave me the twitchies a little bit because I was like, okay, this is either going to be really good or it's not going to be really good. But it really wasn't bad. I enjoyed seeing Peter Cushing. He was a great addition as the perfect character to push that story and provide the lore behind the werewolf mythology. I think everyone did a great job. You know, there was some performances, like you mentioned, that were just a little over the top, but, you know, it was a fun movie. You know, I do agree. I think given a little bit more money, this movie could be great with a remake. Absolutely. You know, bigger budget, better special effects. You know, I was actually hooked on who it is. You know, who is this werewolf? That 30-second break. You know, I was like, okay, I'm going to guess it and I'm going to guess it right. I didn't. I guessed it wrong. And I guessed it was Peter Cushing's character, which it was not.
Right.
So I was surprised. But I really enjoy those kind of movies where, you know, it's kind of like it reminded me of Clue in a way, kind of like Whodunit. But I really enjoyed it. But I gave it 2.5 stars just because. But I think it was really worth the watch. It really was. And, you know, I would recommend people pop this on a Saturday afternoon and give it a go because it's worth the time. It's a fun ride.
Absolutely. And if you never experienced horror from the early 70s, this gives you a good sampling of it. You have the flavor of it. The jazz music that they use was really hip and must have been very popular in 1974. And it kind of adds to the atmosphere. I love horror mysteries, and this is exactly the category that it falls into. So you give it 2.5 stars. I give it 3. Certainly worth a watch if you've not seen it before, and might even be worth a watch if you've seen it. I've seen it about 5 times now, and I always get something out of it. So it's worthwhile. 50 years ago, The Beast Must Die, starring Calvin Lockhart. Well, that's going to wrap things up for our werewolf special. This has been a lot of fun, Tracy. Normally, we have a guest. This time, we treat each other like guests and give ourselves a chance to talk a lot more. And it was a lot of fun getting into some of the werewolf lore and the genre of werewolves, so often overshadowed by Dracula films, vampire films, ghost stories, but there's a lot of good werewolf material out there as well.
Exactly. I totally agree. And, you know, every time we do a show like this or you present me with a list of different movies, I'm always very curious to watch them. And, you know, these did not disappoint. So thank you again. And, you know, I always have fun with these conversations. I'm always learning something new. So thank you.
Thank you, Tracy. Good stuff. We appreciate your contributions over this last hour plus. We thank you. We thank all of our listeners as well for joining us in this Museum of the Macabre. And we hope to see you again next time right here in the Ghostly Gallery.